This podcast is in partnership with Design Biennale Rotterdam, Phoenix Museum, Lack of Guidance, Margreet Olsthoorn, New Institute and Rotterdam Partners, as they all share the common goal to create awareness, share opinions and empower creative growth.
To see how this new generation that is way less occupied with having stuff be education for us instead of the other way around. We are very much a facilitating organization. We do not create anything or invest anything. We nurture. So criticism from others, quite often I find, is the result of them feeling a bit frustrated in their own job, not taken seriously enough. So something that you can tackle.
In today's episode, we sit down with Kim Heijnen, Manager of Media Relations and Public Affairs at Rotterdam Partners. Kim talks about her journey in shaping Rotterdam's image on the world stage, her approach to building meaningful connections, and the role media plays in strengthening urban identity. Tune in to hear how she promotes Rotterdam's creativity and resilience, driving international interest in the city's story. Good day, Kim Heijnen. Welcome in the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's a lovely sunny day, so I cycled over here and I'm in a good mood.
Yes, because today we're at my house. Normally you're somewhere else working, probably the office of Rotterdam Partners, or in the field promoting the city. Can you describe a little bit how your workplace looks like or what you do during a day?
Yeah, we recently moved to the Groothandelsgebouw, which is a lovely building near Central Station. Mm-hmm. It's an iconic building by Hugh Maaskant. So it was already one of my favorite buildings in the city. So when the office moved to the Groothandelsgebouw, I was quite pleased. So I would say 70% of my working hours are spent at the office and the other 30% not at home, but for mostly in the city, just speaking with other people.
How's life treating you at the moment?
Well, I honestly cannot complain. I think I'm quite a positive person.
Yes. You strike me as very positive.
Very positive. No, I think I'm pretty lucky in a sense that my family life is going well. I've got nice friends. A job that also brings me joy, honestly. So there's not much to complain about.
I'm very happy for you. Were there times that you did complain? Because nothing comes without a struggle.
Well, maybe at the start of my career, not really knowing where to go. and the job that I'm doing now, I actually had no clue that it even existed. So there you go. You can't really prepare yourself, I think, when you're a teenager or still in school to what is out there. Yeah. So maybe in that period, I was slightly nervous about what to do next. But over the years, I have learned that patience will take you a long way.
Yes, because I read that you started as a graduated, inexperienced self.
Yes.
How do you feel now?
Much more experienced.
14 years?
14 years now. When I started in this job, I had no direct experience with public relations or media relations. I did, however, study history, which I think, it really teaches you to have a broad interest. Mm. You should have a broad interest because you have to read quite a bit. And I've always been interested in other people. So those things came together, I think, in the job that I'm doing now.
And also, not to forget, hospitality.
Yes.
I read an article about you, or with you, that you mentioned that hospitality, working in restaurants or cafes, is one of the most important elements within your current job.
I feel that working in hospitality teaches you things that you cannot learn in any other profession. That is absolutely the case for myself, because working in media relations also means that you have to be susceptible to the needs of others, just being pleasant to work with. I think it's the most important thing in any job, and this you will definitely learn in hospitality. But also now in the position that I am in hiring people, I really don't care how inexperienced somebody is, especially when you are looking for somebody within a junior position. But if I see hospitality on your resume, that's a plus for me.
Ladies and gentlemen, put it on.
Put it on your resume. No, I mean, because it's hard work. You have to also deal with situations mm-hmm. that are
absolutely
unexpected. You have to be polite, but also stern. But yeah, I think it's the best school that people can have also later in life, when you are in a position when you will go to these nice restaurants or places to be a bit more appreciative of the things that people do for you. Yeah, I have a four-year-old daughter. I think nothing would make me more proud than if she were to choose hospitality as a permanent profession or even as a side job, as is often the case in the Netherlands. I think it's a very, it's something that teaches you quite a bit.
But you were also, and this is how I know you, because we both live, or we don't come from Rotterdam, but we live here for quite a bit. I know you as a DJ.
Yes, that's another side hustle. Yeah.
How was this, and did it help you as well as much as hospitality?
I think so. I like to think that as a DJ, maybe not for all DJs, but it's all about hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, it's not about my musical taste. It should be about the people that are in the room. And I think a good DJ should sense. I also DJed a lot of weddings, and there I learned a lot. Because at the end, you want people to dance and have a good time. And it's not about me. This is not something I like, by the way, but minimal techno from, 9 o'clock on during a wedding will not work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, in a sense, I think DJing is more or less the same as working in hospitality. And it started for me because I was working in Club Vibes. People in Rotterdam. Everyone knows it. And I was working behind the bar, and normally the DJ would come in at 12, but we would open at 11. But more and more we saw that we had these, say, stag parties or groups of people coming in at 11, and made me feel a bit sad that they had to listen to just a CD. Yes, CDs at the time, from beginning to end. So I asked one of the residents, like, can you just show me, like, the basics, just the basics, so then at least, because I feel really bad for people coming in groups often and not much going on. So it's not a good calling card, I think, for a discotheque. So he taught me, and I kind of enjoyed it more and more. There weren't that many female DJs at the time in Rotterdam, so there was also a unique selling point for Vibes. Going out on a limb here, but maybe female DJs are a bit more sensitive to what the people want instead of just playing what you like yourself. So yeah, I always had a great time, and I think the weddings by far were always my favorite parties to DJ, because everyone wants to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
That's what connects them all, the grandmothers and the children. They're all looking forward to this party, so stakes are high, so I was always a bit nervous, but it was the most rewarding gig to do, always.
And it sounds like a very good school to do what you actually do right now.
Exactly.
What does a manager in media relations and public affairs actually do?
That's a good question. If I bring it down to a few sentences, it would be making sure that media knows about Rotterdam. So getting them excited about the things that are happening in the city, and at the same time making sure that what we are showing up about Rotterdam is true and authentic. And in terms of the public affairs bit, making sure that Rotterdam Partners, the company that I work with, has a good reputation, and that we show how we create value in the city.
Sounds like the dream job.
Yes, it is.
Are there also elements that you don't like about the job?
Sometimes, let's just say, managing expectations.
Mm-hmm.
If it were up to me, everyone would be featured in the New York Times or the Guardian at least once. Unfortunately, this is not how it works. What I find difficult is when people are invested in, let's say, a project or a new hotel or a restaurant or a designer, and they are asking me, to help out with media relations, or do you have some tips how to, where I honestly feel that it's great what they do, but maybe more on a local level. So the expectation of the person involved, of course, because it's their, love child, it's their project, is you know, to find a way where you can still be polite and helpful, because there's always something that you can do for everyone. But maybe making the expectations a bit more realistic. And sometimes I would find that people would ask me, you know, oh, could you just, you know, give me some email addresses of the wallpaper or people. But that also is not how it works. Mm-hmm. Because the starting point should be, do you already have a good story? Do you have, sounds very mundane, but do you have good quality images of your project or product? Because without it, it would, everything would fail. So it's managing the expectations and at the same time offering help that would be actually most helpful. And certainly in the beginning of my career, I found that very difficult to convey, because you don't want to give somebody a bad feeling or that it's not good enough. Just sometimes some projects need a little bit more love and care before you can go international. And maybe start local and also consider if something doesn't resonate on a local level. So let's say if the AD or the Haveloads local papers are not interested, it's quite a stretch to think that the BBC would. So as I am explaining this to you, this is more or less nowadays how I also explain this to people.
Mm-hmm.
And to my surprise, most people are actually quite okay with that message. And most of them would even appreciate it and understand it. So, but even now, I still find this very difficult to say.
You're very humble and empathetic, and you always try to feel someone else welcome. Same with me today. Is it easy to actually stress your buttons when people say, I want this, and that there's a border for you, because you're a human being as well, not a machine? Yeah. What, and do you have tips for people when they're in a position like you, for instance?
I think it's always a good thing to try to understand where the question is coming from. Because also in terms of free publicity, there are many reasons why people want to be featured in an article. It could be very much ego-driven. Quite often those people are not pleasant to work with, because it's not about the overall picture or story. It's about them as a person, during which I would think, fine, go arrange this by yourself then. But if it's free publicity or the need for free publicity because it's an excellent project that could be seen as a best practice within a global context, then I find it more easy to work with people. They tend to be more appreciative for feedback, because this is what drives them. They want the free publicity because it will help the project or might even be an inspiration to others. So for me, it very much comes down to why do you want to be featured? And again, if it's very much ego-driven, 9 out of 10 times the people that would request, you cannot see my air quotes, but request a meeting, they wouldn't be the nicest meetings to have. Because I represent the city, I work for Rotterdam Partners, and for some, this translates into, and therefore you work for me. Because I live in the city, I do something great within the city,
yes.
And your company's being financed by taxpayers' money, to put it very bluntly. So this, I still find difficult to do, but if somebody, just being a, cannot see the, say the word, then it's also a no for me.
Yeah. Well, and this is also one of the reasons that I invited you, because I don't personally know you so well, but I did some of the work that you did before, but then on a very small scale. But always with the idea that everyone wants a piece of you or what's out there. It's quite a demanding position, if I'm correct. And sometimes I wonder how much time is there in a day, week, a year for you? Because on one side, indeed, you want to have the best hospitality, but it's also your energy, your time, private life. How do you combine all these ambitions of others and yourself? And how do you communicate this with your partner, for instance?
I have to be selective, because people do want to have a piece of you. And at the same time, I'm very much aware that it's not about me as a person. All the lovely invitations that you get to openings, it's great. But I fully realize that the moment I walk away from this job, and I'm going to do something completely else, those invitations will stop. So this is very helpful to understand. Mm-hmm. It's not about me as a person. It's about what I represent and the connections that I could potentially make. So being selective for me comes down to the people that I work with. Are they in it for the right reasons? As I just said, like what motivates them? Is it really to, to be an example, to start a movement, to add something, something that transcends, having an ego or just wanting to be featured. So the selection process starts there. And then I really focus on the long haul. So it's not so much about the here and now in Rotterdam. So I like to focus on things that are not necessarily taking place now, but that are focused on the future. And this is also a strategy that we've developed at Rotterdam Partners. So when I do have to make a choice, the person involved comes first, and then it's also about the project and the long-term benefit it could have, not only for that person, but for the city as a whole. And then still, I've got stuff to do in the evenings, but I think teachers are also grading papers in the evening. And it's a lovely job. And with it also comes that sometimes you have to make very small sacrifices. Like I have missed a birthday or two, or not of my child, by the way. But
food that you mentioned.
To be selective. And it also means sometimes saying no to certain invitations, which is fine. And people appreciate that too. You can be still connected to somebody without going to all the openings and saying yes to everything.
Mm-hmm. Can you share a little bit your roadmap from the beginning before you arrived in Rotterdam till now? Where do you come from?
I grew up in the city called Zutphen, which is a lovely medieval city in the east of the Netherlands, where coincidentally now already three people that I know from Rotterdam have moved to, which to me is a baffling choice.
To Zutphen.
To Zutphen. Although I have to say, it is a very lovely town. But when you grow up there and you turn 16, 17, there are just a couple of bars where your teachers also go to. I found it a bit too small and I wanted to go to university, which was impossible to do there to begin with because there's not a university. So I had to move. That was clear ever since I was 14 that if I wanted to go to university, that I should move. And it became Rotterdam, because the completely honest answer is that I found it to be the least intimidating of all Dutch cities. And I kind of like the vibe, because my background is quite normal. Just, parents working, grandparents working at the market. So I used to go to markets all the time, also to the Black here in Rotterdam with my grandfather. So that was actually how I knew Rotterdam.
What do you mean with the least intimidating? Because Rotterdam 2 decades ago,
mm-hmm.
when you probably arrived a little bit later.
Oh, I understand. Yeah.
Just okay. For the listener that they don't think like you were.
Well, intimidating in a sense that if you think of Utrecht or Amsterdam, at least that was my perception growing up, the east side, people that were well off. Cultured, cultivated, maybe with influential parents or money. And I didn't get that vibe from Rotterdam. So it was intimidating in other ways. Because I started on the south side of Rotterdam near Zuidplein.
That's a good start.
Good start, 20 years ago. So that was intimidating, I have to be honest. And I also had some unpleasant encounters in my first few years in Rotterdam. But the positive thing to me has always been that when I came here and it became clear to my fellow students at the Erasmus University that I was more or less the only one not from the region. I like to say that they kind of adopted me because it started as then why would you come here? I studied history, by the way, something that you can also do in Leiden or many different cities. So they kind of took care of me. They all came from the area from Rotterdam. So they helped me with a nicer place near the Nieuwe Binnenweg, so a bit more in the center. So at least I dared to go out when it was dark. they helped me find a job at the Alhaven, one of the cafes. And so now fast forward, one of the girls I met then, she's now my neighbor. And everyone that I got to know during my college years, they are still my best friends. So
wow.
This is something I have always valued in Rotterdam. And the intimidating part, I think the past 20 years, the city has changed so much for the better. And I am also sensitive to the fact that some people find that it has also changed negatively. Because it is a different city than 20 years ago, but I have never, ever regretted moving here.
Have you changed a lot?
Myself?
Yeah.
I think so. I think I'm a bit more relaxed. I was a quite high-strung kid to the extent that I would be, well, I could become physically unwell for even the smallest of tests, thinking that those things were really, really important. Also had to do with my parents. I'm the first one within the family to even go to a university. And even though they were not pressuring me to do so, and I did feel supported, it was also kind of the land of the unknown. There was nobody around me who could tell me what student life would be like. I mean, Beverly Hills 90210 was my the best reference. So maybe that made me a bit anxious not to know what to expect, and that you should have, you know, top grades all the time, that every project should be done like outstanding, because otherwise I might not go to university, and what then? So almost a bit fatalistic sometimes. And especially my mom would then tell me, like, you know, whatever happens, the sun will shine tomorrow. And this sounds like such an easy thing to say to your child, but this is actually something that I still try to recall when I'm anxious about other stuff. Like, it's not the end of the world. Like, everyone will forget. It's not as important as you think it may be.
Now, how old were you that you actually realized that the sentence has meaning and that it works? Because it's like you said yourself, it's easier said than done.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have tips for others who think like, yeah, but it needs to be good because this is the chance and otherwise I fail?
There is a, I'm going to quote Cher because I like this quote so much. She has said in the past, like, if it doesn't matter in 5 years, it doesn't matter. And I think that's so true. Because the small stuff, even the, you know, the important deadline at work, or the project that you want to finish, or the graduation paper you have to write. Like, in the larger scheme of things, it's nothing. And nobody cares as much as you do. So for instance, giving a presentation about a certain topic, or even now for me speaking to you, I think 15 years ago, this would not be possible for me without not sleeping for a week and be completely nervous. Now I've come to a point where I think, no, wait, people ask me, yourself included, because of something that I do. For some reason, people think I'm an expert, or at least I have something valuable to share. So let that be the starting point before doubt kicks in. And I think this is something that I'm sad to say, but also many women do, because we can all say, why are there so many men on talk shows? Well, I can tell you. If you ask any man to give feedback about any topic, they would say, yes, sure, I'll come. Whereas I think that the reflex of many women is to say, not sure, what's the topic about? What kind of questions do you have for me? I'm not sure if this is really something, I have something valuable. So maybe, you know, come down, just be appreciative of the fact that you're being asked. And when you are a university, you are there because you had, you know, the grades to match. There's no need to doubt your capacity while you're there. Like, there were many people involved that thought that you would be suitable to do this. Now it's up to you to, you know, not party too hard and make an effort, but just doing the effort should be enough. And it doesn't have to be a 10 all the time.
You've done over 100 press tours. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I did maybe 15, and I'm not looking for more.
No.
For the fact that I love those, but it takes a lot. It also gives you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, how do you do it? Where do you get the energy, the drive? And
yeah, the thing is, I press tours, they tend to be 2 or 3 days, 1 or 2 nights. And quite often it means I'm with a group of journalists from the beginning to the end. I would go home for a sleep, but then early next morning I'll be there. So you will be with the same group of people that you never met before, most of them. And all of a sudden you are together for 48, 72 hours. So you don't have to become friends with them, but it's nice to find some common ground. For me, what really helps, that the trait that I think that all journalists have in common, is that these are people that are listening in order to understand, instead of listening in order to react, as many people do. So they are curious, they're open-minded, and they're just curious to learn more. That's why they're here in the first place. Nobody's coming here to waste their time. So there's an interest, and they tend to be well-traveled, well-read. So it's always fun to speak with them. So just creating an atmosphere where they don't feel hurried, where they can ask all the questions that they want, that they can also explore Rotterdam on their own. So there's always a lot of free time in the program. Just trying to create the conditions that works for them, because I ask them all the time. That's how I learned how to create these press trips to begin with. And then, of course, it's still strenuous on a social level, because you're also the tour guide. And you also have to call people and say, I'm very sorry, going to be 40 minutes late. because, you know, there's something wrong with the subway. Or so all the logistic part can be stressful. The social part can be slightly draining, depending on the group of people. But overall, it's always great to meet new, curious people. And because of them, I get entry to the most creative people in Rotterdam. Artists, engineers, urban planners. I have all this insight in the city because I'm bringing along these journalists. So for me, that's the big plus. I'm learning every day on all these different topics. It's also because of them. Like, if I were just to call them and say, oh, can I come over and can you tell me all about this project? They will not make time for me. But they will, with all these journalists in tow. At home, I always say that the social battery is gone after a press trip. I just want to have a cheese platter, glass of wine, and watch Law and Order. I'm just going to be honest. Or something else, a series. Like, I'm not fit to going out with my partner or friends. I just need to be by myself. Just give me a day and I'll be back in business. But press trips are fun. I mean, there too, I'd like to remind myself, this is how I'm spending a working day, by going to the offices of MVRDV, meeting great architects there, and then go to the depot where a curator is, you know, showing us masterpieces so we can be in their company and get all this insight. And the list goes on and on. So what's not to like?
While you're talking, I'm even thinking about several things. So I'm hearing you speak, and you mentioned at the beginning of this answer with like, and you also close with the, I like you. I like you as a professional and as a person, because you're very likable and you work so hard. And you mentioned at the beginning of the episode that you, if you would move from this position, then nobody will ask you. I see it different. I'm very happy that you're here in Rotterdam. And I think a lot of people, and I hope a lot of people listen to this.
Thank you.
But they will probably think the same, that if you would leave, it would even be a sad day, not just someone moving. And you won't be forgotten. And I think a lot of people will still ask you, because you're an expert in what you do. And that also brings me to a short article that you wrote in 2020 about the 5 things I learned from working with journalists.
Yes.
Over 300 likes, 90 comments. Everyone was very happy with this because they finally knew what PR is, for instance. A question I also got a lot of times. And in, let's see, 5 steps, you explained what it was. I'll just name the topics and then we can talk about a little bit. You basically say, point one, ask questions. Two, know your story. You already shared this a bit in the beginning. Prepare your pitch, spread the message, and a little bit more about the press trips as well. How much do you like this, and could you do this in a different city?
No, I don't think I could do this in a different city, because for me, Rotterdam is, just assuming that I would stay in the Netherlands for my professional life, which I think is quite likely.
Why?
I like living here. I like to travel.
Holland is a great place to be.
Yeah,
of course.
But Rotterdam is a city that is, I know this is such a, also a bit kind of a platitude to say it, but it's ever evolving and changing, which is true for so many cities. But I think Rotterdam has certain characteristics that you will find nowhere else that makes my job fun and enables me also to go a little bit deeper than only, let's say, the lifestyle and the travel stories. So there's a lot to work with. We have the port and the energy transition that they, well, that we all have to be sensitive about. We are a Delta city. We are the lowest point of the Netherlands, meaning that climate change will affect us first. We want to densify the city and at the same time also add parks and more public space. So you have all these things happening in Rotterdam that other cities, international cities, find interesting. The transformation of the Hofboge Park. I don't dare to say our High Line because it's going to be so fundamentally different. It has a water retention facility. It's meant for the residents for mostly. And if other people want to visit, that's fine, but in that order. I think we are setting the example for many other cities in the world. And that makes it really fascinating to be a part of the media relations part, because it means I can tweak the angle and the story slightly based on the country that we want to reach out to. So let's say we talk about climate change and water. For me, it means that stories that deal about water retention, super interesting for Spanish and Italian journalists, because generally speaking, there's a lack of water. But when I'm doing a pitch in the UK, and they have a sewage scandal, it's a very icky story, but something that's really preoccupying the BBC and The Guardian. If I can find a story that fits into that angle, and there's so much to work with. So I could write pitches all day long, because in the end, they're all customized. Like the story remains the same, but the accent that you put on every angle can be slightly different. And I think in Rotterdam, that's the only city in the Netherlands where I could do so. At the same time, it's also because I'm so knowledgeable about the city now. Maybe if I were to do the same for Leeuwarden or Nijmegen, I'm sure I could also find my way. But I would not have that connection, that emotional connection that I do have with Rotterdam.
Yeah, and that's a cheesy bridge, but you studied history. And we are, as Rotterdam, is building the city now. And there's so much potential and growth perspective that you can stay here for many, many years.
Absolutely.
Did you ever doubt your future in Rotterdam, that you thought, like, maybe after a couple of years I want to see it different? Or
no, not necessarily, because I grew up in a leafy environment in Zutphen. And even though I very much enjoy being in a forest or in nature, I'm still at this point in my life where I want to make use of everything that the city has to offer. So in terms of museums and going out to dinner, I might not be going to discotheques anymore, just to work discotheque alone. But no, I do like to make use of everything that's at hand. So for me, it's a city to live in and then going to nature to relax. And maybe at some point in my life, these will change. But for now, I never doubted leaving Rotterdam, ever.
How much has parenthood changed the way you work?
I think only in good ways. Because earlier you mentioned, you know, how do you keep the balance? And when so many people have questions or want something from you, think having a child also makes me a bit more strict with my own time. Am I going to this opening on a Thursday night if it means that I won't be home to have dinner with her or putting her to bed? I don't mind missing an evening or two. I think it's also very healthy for her to see that both parents are working, that we have the life that we have also because we are working. So I also want to set an example. At the same time, we really wanted her to be with us. Like, I'm really happy being a parent, so it would make no sense to not be present as much as I can. But I can be flexible. Sometimes I will take her to, say, an opening at the Kunsthal. She's a great child because she's mine. I'm not objective, but she can be quiet and she's well behaved most of the time. I mean, even just yesterday, my partner who works within the cultural field, he had to go someplace in Rotterdam, and he brought her with him, and she just colored for an hour or so. That was fine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Maybe in a year or two this will change. But for now, this works.
I'm very happy for you.
But yeah, I think it's... I'm better at my job now being a parent.
And why?
Because I've also learned to be a bit more patient, with, let's say, colleagues.
And colleagues are very important for you because... Just to mention, in many articles that you wrote on LinkedIn or wherever, in many cases you quote that you are in a team. Maybe we should name some of these because this is how you do it. So I won't dare to.
No, that's fine.
Can you name some people from Rotterdam Partners who made a big impact on your career or who are now your buddies in war?
Well, when I came in for the job interview, Chantal Mies, who still works there, I was inexperienced. Like, I just finished a university. I did some freelance teaching, but that was it. And I think it was a mid-year position. But I thought, you know, let's go. So the first round went well, but then... I also went to the second round of the interviews and I started to get a bit nervous. Like, oh, I think I might find this a very nice job. So I have to give it my best. So when I got the job and I spoke to her about it later, like out of curiosity, how many resumes did you receive? And it were about 100. So
wow.
I thought, okay. And she said something to me along the lines of, yeah, you were not necessarily the candidate with the best papers, but your enthusiasm and your curiosity, also the whole hospitality matter.
I wanted to ask.
Were the defining characteristics for her to kind of seem, you know, I don't want to say the wild card, but to have faith in me as a person and thinking, you know, press releases, all that stuff. You can learn along the way. This I have never forgotten. I'm still very much in debt to her, I think. If she had made a different choice, my career would have been completely different. So the thing I wanted to say with this story is that now that I am in a position, not all the time, but every so often, to hire someone, this is my reference point. It's not about everything that's on the paper. Should have a conversation with people. Since a year, we now have a new colleague within our team, Claire Schiebroek, who is now 26. We had quite some candidates, and this was also a junior media position that we were looking for. But when I was talking to her, I always had the Chantal Mises remarks in the back of my mind. And to me, she was the perfect candidate, and she's now with us for a year. She's doing absolutely great. I just hope that we manage to keep her within our company for a few more years to come.
Big shout out to Claire.
Big shout out to Claire. And there too, this is a woman who also worked in hospitality. She's a hard worker, not afraid to learn or ask feedback, you know, willing to do the things that are required to do. So yeah, it's nice to, I don't want to say pay it forward, but it's... For me, it's nice that I have earned this job by just being myself and conveying that I was willing to learn and work hard. And I love the city. I want to be a part of the development. And she had a similar thing. And I don't think you necessarily have to hire people that was it as if I was looking into a mirror, but it was just this idea of we can now also choose candidates that might have a stronger resume or a few more years added to their career. But why not invest in people that you feel confident will, you know, will make it happen?
And how much time can or do you spend in learning, for instance, to be in a role of responsibility or call it leadership? Because this is, of course, also new territory. But actually speaking with you, this whole conversation, new territory is actually what you like. Being out of the comfort zone. So you grew quite a lot hearing how you were in Zutphen. But how do you nurture your own talents and ambitions to grow?
Ooh, good question. I like to read, which I have always done as a child. And I think that's good because it gives you other perspectives. Of course, traveling does the same thing or meeting new people. But I'm actually quite an introverted person back home. So I like time by myself, you know, reading, looking things up. I like to go to the city archive, which is kind of a nerd alert, but I like looking at old pictures and getting into these very niche stories and finding, you know, like remarkable things about the city or people. And just generally meeting the journalist and asking them questions. Always gives me new insight as well, because I get to speak with people who are within their field, like the best. To have the economic correspondent from the New York Times coming here a couple of years ago, we hired a van to take us to the Maaslandkering because he was interested in the port. So we spoke for about 40 minutes in the car. Super interesting. Like everything that this guy, I mean... knows. And journalists, they all love to talk about their own work, as most people do. We are all proud of what we do. But super inspiring, not only the people that I meet in Rotterdam, but also the journalists that I speak to about what's happening in their own country. And it's not all about politics or election. Nobody wants to talk about that anymore. Nowhere in Europe and not even the US for a long time. But, you know, just asking them, what is the most interesting person you spoke to recently or when traveling? What was a destination that you thought on forehand was going to be awful but turned out to be great? This is also fertile ground for myself to make surprising choices for a vacation. So, yeah, I think the energy lies in still meeting other people, new perspectives, but also to be solitary at some point.
You mentioned having these trips by car or taxi to a place and then you talk enthusiastically for 40 minutes. I can recall some of my press tours, which were similar and a lot of fun. But I also had once or twice someone who didn't want to talk at all because they were grumpy or tired or were just thinking like, you are PR, I'm a arrived star architect or whatever.
Yep.
Do you have these, or well, I know for sure that you will have, but can you share some of the examples without naming names that you thought like, this is going to be a long day?
Yeah. Well, there's, honestly, let's start with like the journalists that I've met over the years that were truly unpleasant, I can count on one hand. That's my honest question, my honest answer. And of course, with some,
and you, met
you hit it off.
A thousand.
Yeah.
I so read in an
go.
Article.
Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. So... but those are really the, let's say, the unpleasant people. There was one lady who came on a group trip with British media. She was slightly older, but, you know, she had done great stuff. Like, she was a good reporter, also wrote books. Within this group, there were also quite a few, let's say, younger female journalists, also freelancers. And I myself at the time was also, I don't know, 29 maybe, 29, I think. From the get-go, I got the feeling, here's someone who has certain, let's just say, misconceptions about young women nowadays. And that became quite obvious during lunch, where one of the freelance journalists was telling about interviews that she's done with so-and-so, and this older lady, she kept on interrupting and asking questions, but not questions to learn. It was very clear that she was doubtful if the interview ever took place, or just super weird, slightly uncomfortable. So I tried to, you know, bring up a different topic to talk about during lunch. So I said, like, oh, by the way, well, I'm someone who enjoys reading, and I read quite a lot of British writers. Is there somebody new or like a writer you would recommend? I thought this is going to be safe. But then, unexpectedly, she started hassling me. Like, oh, so you like to read a lot? I like to read. So what kind of writers do you like to read? So I named a few, and I also said, well, I also like older writers like Fitzgerald. And she went like, ha, name three novels.
Oh, wow.
So I was completely overwhelmed, but I felt pressured. So I did give her three titles.
That's already a big win.
Because I was so in shock. But then I could tell by the faces of the other journalists in the group, like, that was super rude. Because it was so clear that she was doubting me. Like, there's no way.
Mm.
And then later during dinner, there was this other thing where she asked me, like, by the way, what age are you? So I said, I'm 29. And again, she went like, ha. And she looked to one of the other journalists and said, I told you so.
Oh.
So it was kind of, she was weird and not so polite. And I will never forget, and this is also something I always enjoy with British people. We had one more water taxi right at the end of the tour. And she was slightly older and not so secure in entering the water taxi. And she said something like, oh my God, she was American by birth. She went like, oh my God, I might fall in. And one of the British gentlemen, he said, well, that can be arranged. And that was kind of the vibe of the press trip. But it also created this bond among the other journalists and also myself, although, of course, I could not be vocal about it. That would be very improper. But I could tell that the other people in the group were having an amazing time because they were all looking at her in a way like, what are you doing? Very unprofessional, like also very British. They all apologized at the end of the trip. Like, we do apologize for her behavior. It's like, it's not your, you know, responsibility. But this lady, yeah, she, and I would never name and shame also with other PRs. But I did recall speaking to somebody in the UK, also working in media relations. And we were having this exact same conversation. Like, what is the most awful thing that ever happened on a press trip? This is also a question I often ask journalists, and they have amazing stories, I can tell you. It's a real icebreaker. And she was giving me this story, and it was like, this has to be Miss X. She was like, that's true. So it was kind of reassuring that it had nothing to do with me personally or with the other attending journalists, but that was bizarre, really a bizarre, unpleasant woman. But, you know, journalists also come in all forms. But honestly, again, almost everyone I've ever met is polite, appreciative, because they're also aware that quite often PRs are not very helpful or difficult to work with. So just being a pleasant person to work with and, you know, keep your promises will really get you a long way with journalists.
Mm-hmm. Do you also know what Miss X wrote about the press tip or where she was there?
Well, let's just say I'm still waiting for that article, which also doesn't happen that often. Again, when people come, they tend to publish always. So, yeah, this was the one-off. But, yeah, you can tell I've told this story many times before. But, yeah, it's one of my... it's just one of the few. So that's good.
So, and how does it work for Rotterdam Partners and the municipality, do you always pay for the flights of journalists? Is it then also that you want or need to check if they actually wrote about you? And are there, for instance, people who come just for the fun and then not write about it? Should I do this? Write about Barcelona or not write?
No, this is, again, it's a good question. It's also a question that I understand and we get quite often. So what we do for journalists is that we facilitate. And that sometimes means that we also handle their travel arrangement. But we want people to travel by train. So especially people come from the UK, Germany, Belgium, France. That's easy to arrange. It's not very costly to do so. We also want to be accommodating. So when they do make an effort to come to Rotterdam to write, then we think it's only hospitable. There you are. To provide a hotel and some food. We don't have to go to a Michelin star restaurant, but it should be, you know, it's a sign of appreciation, I think, to take care of them and to ask, even if they're here for an interview, would you like me to arrange admission at, say, the depot? Would you like to go? This is just a small stuff. It does not cost us anything. And it's also something that we do with our partners in the city. So the hotels, they offer us friendly rates. We work together with Eurostar for tickets. If it's also beneficial to them, we work together with the restaurants and the museums in the city. So we don't have to spend that much money on a journalist. So it's mostly the stuff around it. So making the arrangements, making sure that they can speak to the right people. And in my experience, people don't come just for the fun of it because it's also their time. And nowadays, it's never been easier to find out if people are legit. You just go online. People claim that they are a freelancer for The Guardian. You can find out very easily. I mean, I think if you do your homework a bit as a PR, you can make sure that this does not happen. So, and honestly, it doesn't happen to me that often that people come and they don't write. At the same time, we focus very much on future projects. So I'm also aware that it's very unlikely that everyone will publish a week after their visit. To give you an example, the new Phoenix Museum that will open next year, we've been telling about it for years now, taking people to the construction site, getting presentations by their director. So just planting the seed for future publications. So it's not about the here and the now, also in terms of free publicity. That's not the, let's say, the core of what I do, what we do at Rotterdam Partners. It's always for the long-term relationship. People tend to come back. I think I have a group of about 250 journalists that would come back every, let's say, 2 or 3 years, depending on the news.
That's a lot.
And that's quite a lot. So I don't have to make new connections all the time. I think it's way more valuable if you invest a bit more time in, especially the freelancers.
Yeah. Is there also a project that is close to your heart? I can recall one, but I'm not here to answer the question.
Ooh, kind of depends. Like I do.
You can name three if it makes it easier.
I do really like architecture. And I have always enjoyed working with a company such as MVRDV. They did the Mortal, which was also kind of at the early stages of my own career. A couple of years ago, they opened a depot. They're now working at Portlantis. So this is a firm that, you know, keeps on building in Rotterdam.
And it's also how we know each other.
So these projects I really like because it's where several people come together all, you know, of course, all with their own agenda. But we're looking at the common goal here. So, for instance, the Markt Hall. For us, Rotterdam Partners was a great way to show journalists, look at what's happening and what will happen next, because there were other things also going on. The Phoenix Food Factory just opened. Small scale, but still great to show.
Well, you learned me some skills, because I at the MVDV, when I joined in 2016, we did some press tours together, or you passed by. Yeah. And the things that you talked about to me directly or with the press, I was amazed because I didn't know anything about PR. And then I was like, wow, this is what I'm going to do. I loved what you did. So you were a little bit of an example for me at that time already.
Thank you.
So, but yeah, it's I liked the relationship that I saw from you being a DJ and then having this setup through the whole evening, going from emotions, storytelling, and then to see you in storytelling with PR, I was like, yes, this is your job. They have the right person.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think with Marshall, this was really great, and working with MVRDV, that very early on we saw like the added value that the other party was bringing. We wanted to, you know, shed light on Rotterdam as an evolving city, and MVRDV was also an ambitious firm in Rotterdam. You know, the Martel really made a difference for them as well, in terms of projects that followed, their international reputation, even the physical growth of the firm. So yeah, it's a relationship that I truly value, and I think this project was defining also for me, and seeing that if you work with other people, make sure that journalists are connected to the right people. And sometimes that is Winnie Maas himself, and sometimes that's the stall owner that is starting a knot shop with his family. So being mindful of the fact that having the right people involved in a press trip will make all the difference for a journalist.
Do you also know what impact your work has, for instance, on economy of the city, socially, cultural? Do you measure this as a company?
Yes, it's of course we have KPIs. So yearly, I think we reach about 800 million readers by the free publicity that we generate. So I have to.
It's an important one, free publicity.
Free publicity, yes. Yeah. So, and these are all articles that I am always very conservative in counting them. I have to be sure that we played a role in the article because of a press trip, because of a telephone call that I got, or because of the images that we were able to provide. So there has to be a connection with Rotterdam Partners and the article in order for me to say, this is part of our KPI. Because, of course, Rotterdam is written about quite a bit, also in terms of the port or you name it. So only those articles. But I think the biggest value lies in reputation and image. So to give you an example, I have colleagues that work for the Convention Bureau. So they go abroad to these big conferences where they, well, essentially sell Rotterdam as a destination to host a big conference, like the Urban Future we had in June, or the TwitchCon conference. There's a lot of money to be made in conferences. So to get those to your city has a huge economic bonus in terms of hotels and transportation, restaurants. People spend quite a bit while they attend a conference. But let's say 10 years ago, if my colleagues were going to these fairs in Las Vegas or North America, you would always have to say, I'm from Rotterdam. Yeah, it's the second city of the Netherlands. Nowadays, because of these lovely titles that CNN and New York Times having written about us, at least there is this idea of Rotterdam. Crazy architecture, or at least there is more of a reputation than we had 10 years ago. And all these articles, they do help, well, more or less as a conversation starter. I have an American colleague and she travels quite a bit. And for her, it's so helpful during conversation to say, by the way, did you see National Geographic last week? I think that's the value also of free publicity. And sometimes it also means that a project or a company, that doors will open abroad, which I think also has value. Or invites people. Sometimes I would also find during press trips that after a press trip that a journalist would invite one of the people that they met here to attend a conference or a lecture in the country that they're from. So there's the instant KPI, which is important, of course, because we do get funding from the municipality. And at the same time, in the long haul, so changing the reputation and the image, I think, it's very important, even for attracting businesses to Rotterdam. A CEO makes choices based on many, many factors. But I think no one would like to relocate to a city that is not considered to be appealing, or cultural or vibrant. Then you don't got to relocate to this city. So yeah, I'm making this really big now. I think free publicity, it does many things. And at the same time, being in a lonely planet, that was great. But it's also depending on how much value you want to add to this one article. I mean, no one in the world knows about this except the people in Rotterdam. And not all the people in Rotterdam, but those that were present during that time will still consider this to be a defining thing. So context is important.
Do you know a little bit, because you mentioned 800 million readers for free publicity, do you know on a scale in the Netherlands, for instance, with Amsterdam, or European or even worldwide, where it fits in, just to get a...
I really don't.
How much value is 800 million?
Yeah, that's. I think that's one of the trickiest things with NPR. Because I also feel it's not about the quantity. And sometimes you would see that people really want to be featured in the paper, Times. I want to be in the Times, which is great. But if you are featured in the Times and you're on page 42 on Tuesday, might not be the best free publicity. Whereas if your project is featured, let's say, on a blog about sustainable architecture that's being read by 15,000 subscribers, but they're all interested in this niche, it has way more value.
Well, I'm just searching for the reason for pinpointing the KPIs, because if we unleash Kim Heine, then we know it will be fine. But if someone puts a KPI on you and your team, which is a realistic fine, but you also mentioned some people asking from you to do this and this for the publications. I can imagine that some people say, do this KPI and then it will be fine. Although they might not know so much about what you actually do. Did you ever encounter a KPI that you thought like, wow, very stressful, but maybe even unrealistic? And how do you deal with this?
I think the KPI is also something that I am always involved in. So let's say for next year, like me and the other managers were talking about, is this still is this a realistic KPI for next year? And then honestly, I would say, well, I think we can plus 10% looking at all the news worth that we'll be having next year. So the opening of Phoenix, relocation of the Nederlands Photo Museum, Portlantis, starting of Hofboge Park.
There's so much coming up already.
Design biennial. There are many things happening. So depending on a news worth that year, I can kind of plus or say, well, let's pace ourselves. This might be a tricky year to actually. But I think as long as I can explain why we can either plus or be a bit more modest, it's fine. Like it's a KPI. It's an indicator. But in the end, you would like quality publications.
Do you also feel that you have alliances or competitors? And of course, every city is different stories. But through the years, sometimes like events, you have openings at the same moment. And then, well, who gets which journalist? Do you ever encounter these moments?
Oh, not so much. I think I always work from the perspective of a journalist. So when they are traveling from far away, let's say North America or Asia, it would make sense for them to make the most of their trip. And if that means they would like to visit the Maurits House or go to Delft or even Amsterdam, it's fine by me. Because they should look back on the trip like, oh, this was great. And I also would like them to remember me as the PR that is open. they don't work for me. We work together. So if you would like to make use of your time to do other things, absolutely fine. We actually now more and more work together with different cities, including Amsterdam, with my counterpart, because they too have a couple of great museum openings next year. So again, from the perspective of a journalist, it's great if you can say, Here are 4 days in the Netherlands, and you will visit 6 new museums.
Wow.
You'll start in Amsterdam, you'll end in Rotterdam.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to make some noise on social media for this press trip, and we're already completely booked. And these are all top-tier media. So it shows, it's not about the free trip or, oh, we could go to Amsterdam, but it's really making the most of their time. Many of them are freelancers. So they look at the program thinking, these are 6, 7, 8 articles I can write after this trip.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a lot of work as well.
Yes, but it's fun. And you're doing it together. So you can kind of do it together also in terms of effort.
Yeah. Do you ever feel stuck? Or do you have sleepless nights that you think like, well, these press trips, cool, collaborating with different cities, super cool, but just the Excel or the Word document that you're writing.
Yes.
What do you do? And do you have tips for people?
When you are stuck in general or just...
Yeah, just in general, because when I think about the press tour, you talk about timetables and all the things that will probably not happen because of delays and whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Of course, after 14 years, it's easier maybe. Mm-hmm. But in general, how do you prevent yourself from going crazy, still take the overview, and what happens when there's a delay? You think like crisis management?
Well, I like to think there's a solution for everything. There is one thing during press trips I want to avoid at all times, and that's being the typical stressed out PR that's overseeing the project or the trip. So when something happens that is very unfortunate, I would excuse myself from the group and just not be there to do a certain call. So they will not. There's a certain amount of acting also coming into play here. But they could never tell from how I am handling myself that something is about to go wrong. What has happened in the past is, for instance, that the weather was really, really god-awful, to the extent that we had to change the program. But that is a good thing that I've been doing this job for such a long time. I can always call people and say, listen, we were supposed to come this afternoon, but, you know, I have to change because of the weather. And, well, maybe this is a Rotterdam spirit, but people understand, they're willing to be accommodating, and you can change the program. In terms of timing, I always have two programs with timing, one for the journalist and one for myself. And there's always like a 15-minute gap. So when I say we meet in the lobby at 9:30, it means that I would like to start moving at 9:45.
Smart.
Something that I would say honestly to a German a journalist who would ask. this sounds very impolite. I don't mean to do so. But let's say for Spanish and Italian journalists, I would be more strict and say 9:30. Because I know they will be there at 9:40. And they don't mean to be rude, but it's just a cultural thing. They're a bit more flexible with their time management. So knowing this, I'm never running late.
Well done. Who are your biggest supporters? And how do these persons do this for you?
I think my partner is my biggest supporter, which is really nice. We've been together for 17 years. So he also recalls my more doubtful years. So whenever I do feel like I'm not equipped enough or good enough, he would be the first to tell me, like, don't be ridiculous, because you have done so in the past. You have done this before. Relax. And also my group of friends from Rotterdam, like my biggest cheerleaders, always supporting me. And also putting my, you know, show me some support when I need it. We all know the same people more or less because we all work in Rotterdam. And whenever I do doubt myself, or, you know, it could be that they would say, oh, I know this person too. He or she is just, you know, wired that way. Let's put it nicely. So my mind would be, will be assured. I think also my mom is quite proud. Like, I don't think she really understands what I do exactly. But, you know, just for me to move here and to succeed, never to have asked any money for university, is something, because she is such a hardworking person, is something that she really appreciate. She used to work on the market too, and now she has been working in a prison for over 15 years, which is hard work. Like, she's a prison guard, so there's also physical sometimes. But yeah, I have done something completely different with my life than she did. When she was my age, she had three kids, all teenagers, and I myself had already left the house. So that's...
Are you the oldest?
I'm the oldest, yep.
Or are you the oldest?
Yes, I am. So yeah, it's really nice to have that support from her, even though we are so fundamentally different in what we did with our lives.
Did she ever join a press tour?
No, I don't think it would be for her necessarily something that she would enjoy.
Would you host her a press tour maybe?
Well, she,
just a mother-daughter day in Rotterdam.
Yeah, I think she finds Rotterdam a bit difficult, if not ugly. So I have not succeeded in completely, you know, getting my family enthusiastic about the city. They like the street that I live on the northern part, and they like the water taxis and those kind of things. But I think the modernity for her is a bit too much, as well as, you know, the amount of people.
Do you see her a lot? Wait.
Not that often, because it is more than 2 hours away where she lives now. But no, it's good. Like, we have a good relationship, but it's not like traditional that we speak every week and you know, go for high teas in the restaurants or.
How do you deal with criticism?
By not taking it personally, because it always comes from someplace. And I think criticism can be constructive and could be depending on, you know, how you give your criticism. Are you giving this like one-on-one, or are you giving it in a conference room, for instance?
Have you ever experienced that?
Sometimes, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But, you know, kill them with kindness. That's always my my go-to defense. Like,
how do you do that?
It's just like, here comes the hospitality bit again.
Yeah.
So people are halfway through their meal. And you ask them, like, is everything okay? Can I get you anything? And they would say, no, it's fine. And then you remove the plates and they're more or less licked clean. And you would say, great, so can I get you anything else? Was good. Well, actually, and there comes the criticism. It's like,
oh, wow.
Then the response would be, oh, how unfortunate. You didn't tell me when I came to the table before, because then I would have the opportunity to find a solution for you. I think that would be my way of handling criticism in a group. And again, it always comes from a certain place. I think for some people, they are highly critical or, let's say, difficult to work with, because they don't feel appreciation within a group. And then if you are the one that is getting, let's say, the compliments or well done, sometimes it irks people the wrong way. So being mindful of that, and also then be outspoken about the appreciation that you have for these people involved in a project. Because also a press trip, or I have to depend on so many people for help. The interns at the museum that are there to, you know, give away the catalog, and I think it should be there should be more appreciation for people in general, regardless of the work that they do. So it's also about the taxi drivers and the people in the restaurants that are part of this trip. They're all contact moments for the journalist to meet somebody. So criticism from others, quite often I find, is the result of them feeling a bit frustrated in their own job, not taken seriously enough. So something that you can tackle.
When did you actually said this to yourself, like, don't take it personal, because it's hospitality is super personal?
Yes. Well, I had this incident on social media. This is a few years ago. Where on LinkedIn, I made a post about the 5 things that I was looking forward to in, I don't know, 2020. It was very clear. It was all had to do with cultural openings or exhibitions. So it was very much a shout out to, you know, the cultural offerings in the city. This guy, X, again, I will be polite, You made a print screen of that post, put it on Twitter at the time, and he counterbalanced it with like the five things that I'm looking forward to in Rotterdam, to end child hunger and all these like things that surely I would agree upon. But there were, well, you could say apples and pears. But it was so rude. And it really, when I saw it on Twitter, my heart just, I felt awful.
Mm-hmm.
Really awful. And then my partner was so helpful and said, this guy is a to begin with. Everyone that sees this, because, you know, my name was on it and everything. Like everyone, every normal person that would see this post would think, what a peep, because your story is so clearly meant as a positive shout out towards other people. Haters gonna hate. This is also something that I learned, and I'm sure there are many people that when they see my work on social media or a LinkedIn post would go like, oh, she again, which is fine. Like, I don't, not everyone has to like me. But things that do get to me is that when people are doubtful of my intentions, this is something that will make me a bit wobbly.
Well, you're not enough. The only one.
Yeah, I think that's a common, very human trait. But when people are doubtful of why I am doing things, as in my integrity or purpose, this is something I still find difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine. And since, I think, 2020, or let's say safely, since a couple of years ago, you're more active on social media and you're posting incredible posts about city, your profession, whatsoever. You also get a lot of good responses. A lot of people like what you post. Do you see yourself as a personal brand? And if so, how much attention do you give to that?
I don't necessarily see it as a branding purpose, because for me and the social media that I use the most is LinkedIn, or that's my most used channel. I started doing so during COVID because, of course, we could not host any press trips, or at the same time, things were still, you know, being done, and there was still anticipation and a future. At least I always wanted to hold on to the idea that, you know, normal days would return. But I couldn't, you know, churn out these press releases every day. So I thought, why not make it small? So start telling smaller stories. Did you know that kind of stories about Rotterdam? Things that happened in the past, things that were going to happen in the future. And I saw that there, you know, were quite some responses, not only from other people in Rotterdam, but also from journalist, and they tend not to react on the post itself because, you know, they're very demure in that way. But they would reach out to me afterwards, like, oh, I saw your post on LinkedIn. Could you send me more information about this project? Or I've had some really stellar publications just based on a LinkedIn post, because I feel that this works way better for a journalist instead of a press release. It's not intrusive. It's not adding more to your inbox, because, you know, mind you, top tier media, they would receive 400-500 press releases a day, so they are not reading them for sure. So it does take up some time, but over the years I've come to see it as part of my job, and that's something that I should do, you know, outside working hours. It's something that I also do during a working day.
Do you also have the feeling with posting on LinkedIn that you need to do it and that you can't stop anymore?
No, because when I'm on a holiday or just busy with press trips, I'm not doing anything.
No, more not on the short scale, but on the future. That, for instance, that you think like, well, it started as a nice initiative, everyone is happy with it, but it takes up so much time and energy next to what I'm already doing, private life, that you think like, oof, well, maybe I don't like it anymore.
No, I think I will, because I don't consider myself to be a highly creative person or a writer, but the posts on social media are always the result of me reading a book or going to an exhibition or, you know, taking a look at the city's city archive. So it's just kind of a summary of what I already saw, did, or
and they're good posts. I like them.
But it's
well structured, written.
Thank you.
Did you learn this somewhere or from someone?
No, not necessarily. But I try to. I look at these posts as a micro pitch. If this were the only information I was able to convey to a journalist, it should have enough for them to say, "Tell me more." So what's the content? And it's not the content, it's the context. Maybe two or three hard figures to show the scale or the level of ambition, and the striking image, of course, the most important. But the post alone should be enough for a journalist to think, I want to learn more about this project.
Well, keep posting, please.
Thank you, I will do.
Let's do some do or die questions.
Ooh.
Are you more rational or more emotional?
Oh, this is very hard. I would say rational.
Why the doubt?
Because I think my reaction can be still very emotional. But in order to stay calm, for instance, or not taking things personally, you have to be a rational person. So the emotion follows the ration, I think.
Are you more on strategy or intuition?
Intuition. Yes.
Media relations or public affairs?
Media relations.
Promote Rotterdam globally at the expense of local community focus, or prioritize local initiatives even if it means less global recognition?
The latter.
Drive innovation through high-profile, fast-paced projects, or nurture long-term cultural richness with slower, deeper initiatives?
Long-term.
Focus exclusively on attracting international media attention, or develop more grassroots community-focused communication?
Grassroots.
You're doing this so well. They're not so easy. I was thinking about them myself, and I was like, I'm not gonna ask them all. I'm not gonna tease them much. Prioritize projects that boost the economy, or focus on initiatives that enhance cultural or social values.
Cultural and social, because then comes the economy.
Smart, huh? Be a visible public figure leading change, or work behind the scenes to craft the narrative.
Public figure.
Yeah. Nice. And why?
Yeah, because I have found it to be helpful to be a bit more out there.
Yeah. I believe the same. So I'm quite happy that you see it like this. Otherwise, we would do some small talk afterwards. And the last one. Use established media relation tactics, or pioneer unconventional public affairs strategies.
Unconventional.
Yes, out of the comfort zone.
Yes.
Do you have people that inspire you? Or your profession worldwide? Doesn't matter what it is, who it is.
Well, as I said, I like to read. So there are writers that I find really fascinating, historically speaking, or nowadays. I've always been intrigued by the idea of a utopia. So I did my master's also on a Dutch writer, Frederik van Eeden, for those who know him, who started this commune. And of course, this went horribly wrong, because the only people that would come to live there were other writers, and nobody knew how to grow a carrot, so they had to hire people. Long story short, they went bust. His reputation was shattered. And this tends to, happen all the time when people experiment with new ways of living together. But this idea of utopia, and the people that have thought about this concept in history, these tend to be the figures that I'm very much intrigued by. So Thoreau, writing Walden.
Mm-hmm.
There is something about this, having confidence, so much confidence that how you envision the world is something. It's also very dangerous, of course. We all know the other political examples of this reasoning. But to have that mindset, this way of looking at the world, that everything can be made, constructed in a certain way, and then everyone will find the ultimate happiness. This is something I have been intrigued about, like, since my teenage years.
Do you also have the feeling that you're making Rotterdam and also the power that you have as Rotterdam Partners or yourself? Not putting you in a corner, but just very objectively. Because I like the utopian thing, the books and the writers that you mentioned, I like as well. And what Rotterdam Partners is there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But what you mentioned, you are also selective in what needs or wants. And
I think within Rotterdam Partners and the job that I do, it's kind of a contradiction that we are very much at the forefront and at the same time should be in the background.
Mm-hmm.
So people in Rotterdam should know who we are and what we could potentially mean for them. But it's even more important that they understand what we aim to achieve for Rotterdam as a whole with a long-term vision. So the here and now is important. The companies that are here now are important, and the ones that we will attract to come in future years are also important. But this, every city is a living thing and it's changing. And I think it would be a stretch to say that we are such a determining factor in the city. At the same time, we can nurture those people that within their expertise are trying to make a difference, to give them a little nudge. To help them on their way and with their ambitions. So we are very much a facilitating organization. We do not create anything or invest anything. We nurture. Yeah.
Do you see yourself a little bit as a parent to the people of Rotterdam or the people you have?
Well, to the extent that I can be very proud of certain people and what they have achieved. And so for me, then also the reward can be small. It's not the New York Times or the Lonely Planet. To give you an example, Chef Jim de Jong, known him for a very long time, in the beginning of my career. So first he had de Jong en de Jong, which is now de Matroos en het Meisje. Then he went to de Hofbogen. Now he has his restaurant, Renilde. We did quite some press trips with him when he was at the Hofbogen, because that whole area was new. He was, you know, this young chef with vegetable menus. And at the time, that was also kind of, you know, new. So we went there quite a bit. And he once told me that he had French people, Parisians even, that were coming to eat at his restaurant, took a tally just to go have dinner at his restaurant because they read so much about him in the French press. So that's an anecdote that I still very much cherish, because I appreciate him as a hardworking, innovative chef. Everyone is proud of what they do. So to have a small part of him having and the team having a proud moment, like, oh, look, great, we have French guests because they read about us in the... It's the small stuff, but it's...
How do you deal with compliments?
Compliments are always nice, of course. But at the same time, there is this sense of unease when people make very bold statements in terms of without you, the city would have been... or because at the end, as you said before, we are a facilitating organization. I am also facilitating. I'm connecting people. And of course, it's slightly curated because you have to make choices. At the same time, I do not create anything. So as a city, we are where we are today due to the massive efforts of many people. I'm just the one. And I think within Rotterdam, there are other people that would, you know, be worthy of that claim and that praise way more than I myself. It's always nice to hear, but I'm just somebody who tries to make the connections.
And you do it quite well.
Well, thank you. That one I will take.
Okay, good. Do you feel responsible for this generation and the next?
The generation here in Rotterdam, you mean?
Good question. Thank you. Let me try to answer this one. Maybe the people who do the same what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start there.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like to think that whenever I give a presentation, let's say at a school or when we have students coming to the office, I hope that some of the things that I would give back to the students is something that they can work with. Things like don't take it too personal and be mindful of the needs of the journalist and not so much what you want to say. And there in the middle lies the sweet spot. I do feel responsible for new people in the office, like to make sure that they have a nice balance, you know, working and having their own private life. Although I have to say that the youngest generation at the office is actually more an inspiration to me than I think the other way around, because they're way more capable of saying, yeah, this is my free day or I'm taking time off. So well done. I think this new generation has their priorities in place, maybe more so than ours. Not expecting too much of a job. I am very much aware that the fact that I am enjoying my job so much is not the case for most people. Many, many people just work because they need the money to pay their bills, go on a holiday. It's not, you know, what drives them or gives them the great sense of... And I think that's a very refreshing way also to appreciate your work or your work life. So hopefully, sometimes I say things that are helpful to the younger generation. At the same time, meeting younger people also through my work, you know, by visiting architects, think, wow. The hope, you know, I am more hopeful for your generation of being more susceptible to being healthy, to creating healthy environments, healthy cities, and wanting to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think especially the part of wanting to be a part of it, to be a bit more outspoken. I think those are good traits and also things that we need.
A lot of people have different experiences, and what you hear the most is about what Gen Z doesn't do, is putting up the extra notch in the work. Mm-hmm. But what I'm very happy about what you say is they take better care of their well-being and maybe their goals. Seeing the work that you do, and especially during these press trips, which takes more than a 9 to 5, are they able, to do so, and how is your perspective seeing so many media worldwide that they don't put in the effort?
I think there are, will always be people that are more than capable to do this job. I think maybe even a better question could be, are we still doing it the way that I'm doing it now in 10 years to come?
Thank you.
because even with during COVID, we did a couple of press trips online, which is hard to do. So then the speaker has to be excellent, because otherwise you're not watching a screen. The person should be excellent and very, they should really know about the subject. So for instance, the architect of the Hofbogen Park giving a presentation, this is something that interests many people. So that was successful. But the whole idea of getting people physically to come to your city and experience firsthand how everything, people are stretched for time. Resources, freelancers, sometimes they don't get paid more than 50 euro, 50 for a whole story, including photography. So being able to adapt to these new circumstances, understanding the impact of social media and how you can also use that as a tool, as I am also doing on a very small scale. I think this next generation is, because they are more critical of their time, they also have less distraction, I think. And where our generation and the ones above us have always been busy with gathering more, or at least retaining the status quo, I think this new generation, because so many normal things are out of reach, you know, having a house that you can buy, for instance, unthinkable, right? So what's driving you to work 80 hours a week? So what's driving you to work 80 hours a week?
Good question.
Yeah. Not a house if you're not able to afford one. So I think it's going to be refreshing the next decade or two to see how this new generation that is way less occupied with having stuff be education for us instead of the other way around.
Where are you in the coming decades?
Well, I think at least for this coming decade, it will be Rotterdam. Me and my partner would like to travel to Italy. So that's the dream. Of course, everyone has this relocation dream. So maybe in a decade or two, having a small place somewhere in Piemont, not for every day, but for a couple of months a year, that would be nice. And job-like, I don't know, because I never really made a plan. And so far it's going well, or at least I'm enjoying myself. Maybe at some point I would like to go freelance, I'm not sure, or do something different altogether, because so far my career has been one big, well, not so much surprise, but, you know, just go with it and see how far you can come.
And it goes super well.
And it goes very well, and I hope still with my same friends, family, and yeah.
Please keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much.
That was my conversation with Kim Heine. Her work shows that making a real difference requires more than just strategy. It's about hospitality, practical experience, and genuine connection. Kim highlighted how welcoming others and managing expectations are at the core of successful media relations. Her focus on building trust and creating memorable experiences is what makes Rotterdam's story resonate globally. Take Kim's insights to heart. It's often the personal touches and practical skills that leave a lasting impact. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to click the follow button, rate the podcast, subscribe to the newsletter, and spread the word so we can continue to grow the Don't Waste Eye podcast. And remember, everyone struggles, and that's okay. But standing still prevents you from growing and reaching your potential. Keep moving forward, because the better you become, the more you'll inspire others. Don't waste your time, don't waste your eye.